can't rewrite history. Not one line.
Welcome to the 32nd episode of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour Crisis in Time. Every issue, every tie-in, every zero issue. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Beth.
And this episode is the first of two epilogue shows, where we look at material published sometime after Zero Hour that connects to those events. Specifically, in this case, Booster Gold number 0, Adventures of Superman 522, and Impulse, Bart Saves the Universe. Bass, was it strange to read comics written in later eras all of a sudden?
Well, yeah, it was kind of strange, but then again, it kind of felt like exploiting plot holes. But you know what? I don't hate it, so it's fine.
We are not doing these in any kind of order. It's probably appropriate for Zero Hour. Cover dated April 2008. It's the most recent one. Booster Gold number 0 is quite late for a zero issue.
Yeah.
But I think it still plays the game. In case people don't know, the 2000s Booster Gold series had him as the greatest hero the world has never known, protecting history under the direction of Rip Hunter. And so the story could intersect with any era of DCU history, including some of its most famous events. And no one would suspect Booster had this important role because he'd been a capitalistic celebrity hero in the first series, which earned him the title of DC's first new hero after Crisis, and then something of a joke in Justice League International. Do you have much history with the character, Bass?
I did read a lot of Justice League, the Bwahaha years, you know, the sitcom years, and I really did like Booster Gold. I always really liked the combo, the golden-blue combo. I always liked Blue Beetle and Booster Gold together. They just feed and just bounce off each other very well, and it just feels good to see these two together.
You're going to be in heaven about this particular issue if you like the blue and gold combo. Of course, that was born in Justice League itself, which for Booster is a bit of a takedown. It's supposed to be the comedy version. So if that's all you know of the character, you're missing a few parts.
I think the first time I saw him was in The Death of Superman, because he did take on Doomsday, if I recall.
Yeah, with the rest of the Justice League.
Yeah.
When it came out in 1986, what I liked about it, first of all, it was a very different kind of hero because he had an agent and he was trying to get his face on TV and sponsorship deals. And it was a very 80s thing to do. And he had a great look that allowed him to survive, I think, longer. That series only ended up with number like 25 with Millennium. For me, it's like the reason I really got into it, I think, is because like the first 18 issues, the first year and a half was just one long storyline, really. There was a lot of different parts to it, but it felt like his origin and who he was and his, from the beginning, he's on a redemption arc. You know, other heroes look down on him for his attitudes. So he's always on a kind of redemption arc in a way. And that takes a year and a half. And then after that year and a half, I don't think they knew what to do with him, really. And it's not until this particular... And also they lost like the inker and I thought like whoever worked on Dan Jurgens' pencils after that. It didn't look good, or I don't know. But I did love this new take. I love time travel stories. Booster Gold has sort of a secret hero in this. I thought that was like a very, very clever way to use him. And I don't understand why that series ever ended, quite frankly. New 52? something. I could say I'm a fan of Booster Gold as a solo hero. It's not just Justice League love. So let's look at this number 0 here. It fits between issues 6 and 7. And what you need to know is that Booster has just crashed the moment where Maxwell Lord kills Blue Beetle and has stopped it from happening with the help of three other Blue Beetles, because Ted Kord is his best friend, after all. I mean,
well, yeah.
Let's get that duo back together. So Booster Gold number 0 by Jeff Johns, Jeff Katz, Dan Jurgens, and Norm Rapman. It's called Blue and Gold Chapter 1, The Secret Origin of Booster Gold. Booster and the Beatles are, that sounds weird, are explaining the situation to Ted when their time sphere crosses paths with Parallax and Extant in the middle of Zero Hour. Extant has just killed or aged the Justice Society, but the villains haven't shown their hand yet, so they can't allow these heroes to blow the whistle on them. The fight ends with Extant pushing the time sphere to Booster Gold's time, where it crashes on the day Booster ruined his football career by throwing a game and getting caught. Having just changed history, he thinks he can do it again and save his sister Michelle. If he never becomes Booster Gold, she never tracks him down to the past, doesn't become Gold Star, and doesn't die in action. But he can't undo all of Booster Gold's good works, including saving Ted just now, so instead he decides to borrow the time sphere he originally took to the past, currently in the Space Museum, to go save Michelle before returning the sphere with Rip Hunter's help. The Black Beetle sends Dan Garrett and Jaime Reyes away with thanks before leaving himself, leaving Blue and Gold to it. Except Rip's lab is a mess and OMAC robots are on their doorstep, there to eliminate the both of them. And that's Booster Gold number zero. And the things we don't know yet, the Black Beetle from the 27th century is really a villain working with a group to change history for their own purposes.
Yeah.
The fact that Ted was not killed by Max created a divergent timeline where he successfully took over the world with the OMAC project. At the end of this storyline, Ted returns to the point of death to set things right, but ends up fighting with the Black Beetle and disappearing, and it's never really resolved. Fortunately, by Blackest Night, Ted is a zombie animated by a Black Lantern ring, etc. So if he's around today, it's because of Rebirth, and it has nothing to do with these events. Unfortunate. They teased us with his return, and then, of course, he couldn't return.
Welcome to comics. I mean, it's a game of teases and not so much teases. The OMAC thing at the end, I was like, why are there? But then I remembered this is part of the countdown thing from the Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
And if you change one thing in Countdown,
yeah,
you change everything.
Exactly.
Maxwell Lord wins.
I kind of enjoyed this story. I kind of enjoyed them just all of a sudden intruding on a meeting that we never saw really in the previous comics. I mean, we knew Parallax told us that he was, you know, he was pulling the strings behind Extent and everything. But I don't really remember like this conversation.
No, it doesn't, because there are two moments in here that are hindsight. So one is Parallax telling Extant what to do, or Extant reporting back to him.
Yeah.
We couldn't see that because they were withholding Parallax's involvement, you know, for as long as possible. So we would never have seen this early scene. And the other thing is, and I know this is kind of sort of covered in Zero Hour, but the fact that Booster confronts Extant, because he knows it's Hank Hall, he knows it's Hawk.
Yeah.
The former Hawk, former Monarch, you know. And he tells him, like, why would you ever want to do this? Why? He doesn't reveal. I don't want to say reveal, because I think that it was sort of covered in Zero Hour. But here it is so clear that he's doing it to bring back Dove, that he's been promised by Parallax that Dove, his brother, would return.
Yeah, yeah.
It's clearer than it's ever been, because they were also, in the original series, trying to withhold. Who is Extant? Why is Extant? Who is Extant working for? Why is he doing this? That is all kept to the towards the end, and then it's a bit of a rush. So I felt like this scene was something that should have been in Zero Hour in the first place.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that's why I enjoyed it so much. I was like, yeah, this is a little something that should have been in the original series, but it's some like 20 years afterwards. I mean, it's been a while.
14 years. Yeah, I think it is in there, but it needed this kind of emphasis.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's one of the problems that we picked up on, you know, that we noticed in the Zero Hour series, is that the villains didn't really, especially Extant, could have been anyone, basically. You know, there was so little characterization to it. Because they were trying to keep... It's like the mystery was working against the story, in a way.
Yeah.
This is what this teaches me. So I think, like, the Booster Gold number zero, it's both the Zero Hour tie-in, because we got a moment in Zero Hour, and then it's also the zero issue, because it touches on his origin, and also, at the same time, explains the current premise as well. So it's both a zero issue for this series, and it goes back to the beginning and gives us the origin from the original series.
Yeah.
That's well done as well.
Yeah. I really, it's nicely written. I didn't know that Booster Gold had a sister. I don't know why I didn't know that, but.
Well, she dies in the original series. They did make a weird mistake here, because Michelle is drawn and colored as if she were Trixie Collins, Booster's manager's assistant. She was a redhead.
Okay.
She had that haircut and also wore the Gold Star costume. So when you think of Gold Star, maybe you think of that Gold Star. But Michelle, who also wore it, she wore it on one mission and died. But she was blonde like her brother. She had a very different haircut, very 80s haircut. But I don't know what's happening, because Dan Juergens created these characters. Like Booster Gold is his creation.
Yeah.
Goldstar is his creation. Trixie is his creation. So why is he making this mistake in the art?
Oh, that.
You know, why is Michelle Trixie visually?
Yeah, yeah.
Like maybe he changed her hair and then the colorist made it orange. At the same time, they really didn't have the same hair, man. It was really different.
That's a weird thing. If it's on purpose, why would it be on purpose?
Like, especially since, I mean, we see the Space Museum. That's all a throwback to his original origin. The Legion Ring, the Brainiac 5's force field is in there. The Time Sphere, it's all drawn the same way it was in early issues of Booster Gold. Bonus, Batarang, and Adam Strange's helmet. And even Skeets. Like, Skeets has a different appearance in this series. He's flatter. He's on the cover.
Yeah.
You see him on the cover. He's flat. But the original one was more egg-shaped.
Yeah.
And he's in the future because they go back to the Space Museum before Booster Gold ever works there. And before he becomes friends with Skeets. Although Skeets seems to already have a sort of... He's a gentler, kinder, gentler AI because the other robots, the other guard robots are all like, you know, Skeets unit. You know, I don't want any lip from you. You know, when you're called to violence, you commit violence or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So it seems like Skeets is already, like his boss already doesn't like him.
Something in common with Booster, you know.
Yeah, and they become friends and whatever, you know, and he follows them back to the past. They're just like, you see the time wave catching up because when, I didn't mention it in the synopsis, but when they go into the time sphere and go back, suddenly the historical changes, you know, catch up and Skeets and all the other robots are OMAX.
Yeah.
For one panel. So that's cool. But still the original look for Skeets. So Dan Jurgens remembers things.
He does.
Like there are other changes possibly to this origin. So you might say, well, people know Gold Star. You know, they remember Gold Star from her Who's Who entry or something. They think of her as a redhead with that particular haircut. Let's crisis this. Let's just say after Infinite Crisis, that's what Michelle looked like. Maybe Trixie doesn't even exist anymore. I don't know. It's not really mentioned because I don't know if it's a change. Like all this stuff with, I don't feel like it's ever been explained before that he was gambling on his own games and throwing games because his mother was sick. Or because his father was forcing him so he could pay his own gambling debts. I'm not sure I like that because it just seems like his story is then less of a redemption arc.
Yeah.
If he was already pretty altruistic. But I don't remember this from other tellings.
Well, altruistic. I mean, it feels like he has the quintessential daddy issues where his dad wants something and Booster wants his dad's love or approbation. And yeah, it's not really a redemption arc. It could be like a coming of age, understanding the world. You know, redemption, not that much.
But originally, it felt very redemptive. Like, I don't think we had these details, nor a father with a creepy scar or anything.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, dad's kind of creepy.
I think the scar is supposed to be, I mean, if I read between the lines, his loan sharks did that to him. And so he's desperate for money and he's forcing young Michael to do this stuff.
Poor Michael.
This is the joy of this series anyways. Let's go back, look at the origin. Let's go into our crossover event and, you know, write a new page for it. Let's have all the Blue Beetles in it. You know, the current Blue Beetle, the one we love, but also Dan Garrett, who was the Golden Age Blue Beetle.
Yeah, that was cool.
Plus this new evil guy that we just are learning to know. This is what the series was like. It's like, let's go back to pivotal moments and do it with a certain sense of fun.
Yeah, it's a bit Doctor Who-ish in a sense where, you know, it's time travel or travel with a buddy or with fun and real circumstances and real things at stake. You know, it's always in good fun.
Well, this is a zero issue. So let's play the game one last time based on this one comic. Would you keep reading Booster Gold?
Actually, I would. I would, even though I enjoyed the Blue and Gold, I really felt like I got to know Booster Gold a bit better in this comic book. And yeah, I would probably. And I mean, I dig the costume. I just love this costume.
I don't like it when they change it into like a obvious armor, that kind of stuff.
No, I don't like armor Booster Gold. I like classic Booster Gold.
And there have been a couple. This isn't like the original exactly, but it's close. So when they keep it, you know, very basic like this. I think it works well. And with pants. I think it looks better with pants than without pants.
Yeah, always pants.
New 52 made him Canadian and no pants, I think, was the
I can't remember reading the New 52 version of Booster Gold.
It was in the Justice League International book. And okay. It didn't really last long. It was supposed to be an international team. He was the Canadian because we are well known for football.
And our Booster Goldishness.
You know, our celebrity culture. He's such an American hero, you know?
I know.
Next up is April 1995's The Adventures of Superman number 522, about 5 months after Zero Hour, or Zero Month, actually, where you might remember it seemed like Metropolis was all rebuilt after its destruction at the hands of Lex Luthor. Was it a Zero Hour effect? No. This is where my whole, hey, didn't Zatanna help recreate the universe false memory comes from.
Okay.
So months after the events of Zero Hour, they finally tell us how Metropolis was resurrected. It's all in Adventures of Superman 522 by Carl Kiesel, Stuart Immonen, and Jose Marsan Jr. It's called City of Hope. Presented as an editorial by Perry White, City of Hope tells the story of how, once that Zero Hour business was taken care of, the assembled heroes of Earth, or some of them anyways, helped rebuild Metropolis. Perry remembers how he and his wife had been among the hostages taken by a man who cracked under the pressure of losing his home in the destruction, and how the heroes had to fight the hostage takers after they took a demon drug that turned them into monsters. He remembers how they cleaned up the mess and repaired as much as they could. Then Zatanna appears and offers to cast a spell that will return the city to its former glory. Superman's memories include exact plans. He's seen it in every kind of supervision. Martian Manhunter can create a telepathic link between them. And Perry White is there to keep Superman's vision from being too utopian. Perry is the soul of the city, and its heart, from where the spell must be cast, is the Daily Planet. Powered by the energies of other heroes present, Metropolis is born anew. All but the Daily Planet globe, because Perry wanted to use the original, which Superman places on its mount as if to declare that Metropolis is back. In epilogue, we finally understand why the Newstime building survived the destruction, as its owner and publisher Colin Thornton reveals himself as Lord Satanus, and that he summons Zatanna. While at the planet, Perry gets teased for calling himself the soul of Metropolis in his article.
Rightfully so.
Yeah, and the cover is exactly that moment where Superman puts the globe back on the building. Very weird that they included Bloodwind on that rooftop because he's not in the issue. And also, Bloodwind is Martian Manhunter. They're the same person. So he's there twice.
That's weird.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening there. Because all the other heroes are there, correct? Maxima and Guy Gardner and Impulse and Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel? And the Guardians there, yeah? I don't know. Inexplicable. Anyways, so what would you think of this issue?
It started off kind of boring, I must say. There's a, you know, war zone, everything's broken, everything's beige, everything's... Even up to the fighting the demon-drugged people, it was kind of boring. And all of a sudden, something went into high gear. And it really started to take shape when they started building stuff. I mean, the whole fighting and the hostages and the whole...
That you felt was, we need an action beat, so yeah. This is just like what they thought of the action should be?
It was superfluous. I mean, it was just there to be there, and I didn't really enjoy it. But once they started rebuilding, the rebuilding is everything that, you know, all of a sudden they're like, okay, yeah, we're not architects. We can't do this. How do we? They start working together to rebuild and do stuff, but, you know they can't do it all magically.
They're basically creating shelters. That's, you know, or repairing buildings that are kind of okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's never going to be Metropolis.
Exactly. And I love seeing superheroes struggle, even though they have this incredible power. They're struggling to find a way to fix these things. And, well, magically, Zatanna gets there. And even that part is very intriguing, how everything is set up to she can't do it alone. She can't do it only with Superman and everything. So that part was really interesting. And that's where I think the story really gets its legs. Yeah, I really enjoyed the back two-thirds of the story.
I love Zatanna in this. She appears out of nowhere. It's showtime. It's very much a Zatanna dressed to be on stage.
Oh, yeah.
Because the first time I ever met Zatanna, she had like the little snake on her head, and she was a member of the Justice League. So
she wasn't
being played like this. She was being played as a superhero. So when she got back into this costume, to me, that was like a little, I don't know, like a throwback or something. I wasn't too sure. But this is one of the appearances that really sells me on it, because when she uses Superman to reimagine, to redream the city into existence, you know, she does it like, I need a volunteer from the audience. It's going to be Superman. Everything to her is like a magic act.
Yeah, and that just gives so much strength to the character, right?
Like, if we could go a little bit back to just so my comments on the first parts that you didn't much enjoy. First of all, I like that it's an editorial by Perry White. So we get a different voice for the narration. So that at least, I think, works. It's not how editorials work, you know, like scoops and information people didn't know. Like, how come this wasn't reported at the time? It's a little bit. But it's a device and it's fine. And I understand it. And it's about, you know, letting a different kind of prose tell the story. And I do like that. In the fight with the demons, and here I gotta mention the Who's Who show, because, you know, the latest episode that came out, 1993 update or whatever it is, every time they got to a Superman villain or character from this era, Rob kept saying, oh man, the Superman books at this time were weird. Like, the threats were strange. And Lord Satanist was actually in that issue. So it's like, why is Superman fighting Satan and like these very strange characters? And in this, it's like, you can see it here, the demon drug that Lord Satanist is distributing that turns you into a demon.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's weird. But you know what? It's what happened in that time. I mean,
yeah. Well, Superman has you got to work to his weaknesses when you create villains. One of his weaknesses is magic. He's going to get some magic villains. There's one bit I found very forced in this whole fight thing. And it's a weird reference to Captain Marvel being called the Big Red Cheese by his enemies in the old comics. That was a thing. You know, Sivana called him the Big Red Cheese.
Yeah.
And so here you have Martian Manhunter take the form of a demon and say it like he wants to eat Captain Marvel. And that's the distraction for the other demon. And like, Billy couldn't have punched that thing without his help, without that distraction. First of all. Second of all, you're Martian Manhunter. You're one of the top three. Well, no, they're all pretty strong here. Maximus, you know, pretty powerful characters. Wouldn't you be more useful right now punching demons rather than, you know, creating distractions like you're just an illusionist? I don't know. So that whole thing was just like, how do we plug in Big Red Cheese in a scene? And that's what it felt like. And I don't think that works.
It really doesn't. And, you know, using, I mean, I know all these superheroes are mega powerful. What's Martian Manhunter going to do? Punch somebody else? I mean, this is the punch club. Everybody's punching everything. Even Wonder Woman is just like, hey, I'm just going to parry all your strikes and wrap you up. But she could have just punched that big cockroach with tentacles, you know. It's a weird fight, and that's why it's out of place. I mean, I get it. We have to see that Satanist is there, but that fight, just so nothing.
It's the first act. You know, you want a bit of fighting for the kids. Or else this would have been the issue that people would have said, well, it's just an issue about, you know, superheroes building shelters.
Superheroes talking.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't. Getting back to the good part, John's creepy arm, third arm that comes out so you can...
Oh, yeah, that's great. I love that.
A lot of good bits, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Shazam and, or Captain Marvel in this case, and Impulse just chuckling it up because they're like, yeah, she's just talking backwards. That's not a spell.
They're both acting like kids. And the Cap gets told to act his age by Wonder Woman. And Impulse, I love Impulse. Impulse says, yeah, Cap. Of course, we know that Captain Marvel is actually a kid.
Yeah.
So he's acting his age. And it makes sense that he and Impulse would be like the two scamps here. But how he's thrown under the bus by Impulse, that made me laugh. And then you got Maxima, who recognizes Guy Gardner's new colors. Like, oh, I understand your markings as to be this warrior race. So she knows, like, by this point, it's been revealed in the Guy Gardner comics.
Yeah.
But it, like, this would have been like the first, for him, the first clue. On the whole, I gotta say, this whole idea of recreating Metropolis, warts and all, thanks to Perry White, it's not gonna be It's probably more utopian than it used to be, but it still got to have the slums. And, well, on the whole, I like this idea better than how they rebooted the universe in Zero Hour itself. Like, if all the heroes had pooled their memories to recreate the present, it would have had a weird effect on the Legion's time frame, mm-hmm. and there could have been some small changes here and there, as there are at the end of this.
Yeah.
But instead, we just got another big bang, and then the differences were just random, apparently.
Yeah.
Although, inexplicably, given the age of the universe, 1994, pretty much unchanged. So I think that's really lame. This idea, which they obviously had later, this is such a better idea for recreating the universe, whether you use Zatanna or another of the big magic heroes to do it. You know, everybody would have had input. And then you could have had Zero Month, where some heroes might have tried to game the system and get their loved ones back or something.
And
you could have played with the monkey's paw, where it didn't turn out the way you got your wish, but it didn't turn out the way you wanted. Or, you know, those heroes were all present. So when they come back, they know there's a difference, but nobody else seems to know it or something. But again, Zero Hour as a crossover event was so rushed and everybody piled onto it and sort of denatured it that we never could get this crisp and clear an idea the way that, you know, a regular writer on Superman could do what he wants in his own book. But I like this idea a lot better.
It's a great idea, and it's a great way to recreate the universe and not make it the same as it was, but not make it one tyrant's vision. And it would have been great. It would have been awesome.
We're going to take a small promo break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Impulse and his sequel to Zero Hour. Stick around.
Beginning in 2018, the Who's Who podcast enters the 1990s with our coverage of the Loose Leaf editions.
Featuring Superman by Jerry Ordway.
The Joker by Brian Bolland.
Wonder Woman by George Perez.
Sandman by Mike Dringenberg.
Batman by Norm Brayfogle.
The JLI by Adam Hughes.
Eclipso by Bart Sears.
The Legion of Superheroes by Keith Giffen.
Dark Stars by Travis Charest.
Lobo by Simon Bisley.
Kent Shakespeare by Chris Sprouse? Who is that?
Doomsday by Tom Grummett.
Wait, are we covering these by issue or in alphabetical order?
The Justice Society of America by Mike Parabek.
The Forever People again? You are f***ing kidding me.
Doom Patrol by Richard Case.
I'm so confused.
And many more. The Who's Who podcast, going boldly into the 90s.
A proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I guess.
We're back. We're talking about sequels to Zero Hour. And Impulse was in Zero Hour, like the entire Flash family, but a minor part. He didn't have the exact costume yet, and was very new to the 20th century. By 1999, when Bart Saves the Universe came out, he'd had his own series, had been a member of Young Justice, etc. So he's well established. This was my first read of this particular book, not because I wasn't an Impulse fan, because I was, but I had stopped buying comics in the late 90s because I needed to pay the rent more. You know,
yeah.
That's how it goes. Did your love for Wally West the Flash take you into Impulse territory as well, or did you not follow the spin-off?
No, I loved Impulse. I still think that Impulse is the greatest sidekick Flash never had. I enjoyed that. I really enjoy that Wally did not want a sidekick, and he ended up not training Impulse, but Impulse was trained by Max Mercury, and that whole story just transcends generations. You know, we have this active Flash going about doing his thing, and we have this guru Zen type speedster in Max Mercury who's trying to train this young, brash, impulsive Impulse. And Impulse just becomes this charming character who just always tries to do the right thing, but he can't sit still. I mean, he needs to move all the time, and Max is the exact opposite. I mean, if you look at him, he's hardly ever moving. He's when he moves, he moves, but he's always, you know, standing still. And it's such a great combination, these two. And Wally, it's not that he doesn't want Bart around. He just doesn't want a sidekick, and he's not into training because he's trying to figure out stuff for himself. And And I really loved that dynamic, and I really liked Impulse. He was a great addition to the Flash family.
Well, let's get into this book and its synopsis. Impulse, Bart Saves the Universe, is by Christopher Priest, Jason Johnson, and Edwin Rosell. In 1941, Extant robs Max Mercury of his speed and knocks out the entire JSA. The Linear Men rout him before he can do more, and aside from saving a few bystanders, decide they've nipped it in the bud. But they don't notice Max. Cut to the present day, and Impulse is being a pest to every superhero out there, desperate to be regarded as a great hero, at least worthy of more than one exhibit in the Flash Museum. Then a battered Linear Man appears, trashing the One Impulse exhibit, and tells him to go back in time to stop someone before he wins. And he blinks out of existence again. The next day, Bart finds an entirely different family living in his and Max's house, and no one seems to know him. Barry Allen's not dead. Wally is married to an Angela, and neither of them are Flashes. It's all different. Max Mercury appears, heavily wounded, and tells them what happened back in 1941. That Extant tricked the Linear Men by arranging for them to save bystanders, including one who should have died. This Dr. Garnet Edwards lives to create a doomsday weapon tested in outer space, and so powerful, it threw off the Earth's orbit just enough to create a world without a Green Lantern, or without a Flash, or a Superman. No Green Lantern, no Parallax. Extant gets to carry out his own plan in 0 hour. Baby Kal-El lands in Uganda and becomes some kind of villain. Barry Allen misses the lightning bolt by a second, etc. Because Bart is from the future, the time changes haven't caught up with him yet. So he's the only hero who can stop Extant. And on that, this version of Max dies. Bart improvises a cosmic treadmill and runs to 1941, where he indeed does defeat Extant and is returned to his recognizable time by the Linear Men. A ripped piece of Extant's cape becomes a new exhibit in the Flash Museum as a result.
It's a nice little time travel story with a lot of very cool moments.
I mean, obviously this is going to be comedy. I mean, like the bit where he's riding on the coattails of every other superhero and they're all going, I don't need help.
Yeah.
You know, some good ones there. You know, he's sitting on Metron's chair. He's shooting a bunch of arrows. He's with Red Arrow and shooting a lot of arrows. And you see a little bit of blood there. No hero wants him around.
Even, I mean, there's comedy in the art, the style. I mean, everything is very, very cartoony.
You need that for Impulse.
Oh, yeah. And you'll love that for Impulse because, or else he kind of feels weird. He's really, I mean, superhero version of, he's basically Roadrunner. He's fast. He's quick. He's where he shouldn't be. He kind of taunts people. He's just great. I just love him.
We know he plays video games. He was raised in a video game,
yeah.
Essentially, you know, like he's something like 4 years old, but he was force grown and given an entire childhood,
yeah,
in this simulation. So for him, video games in the world are kind of the same. And he's struggling with what is real. Well, what is real and what isn't. But really, do you accept that there is danger and responsibility when everything is a video game? And we see a bit of this in here. You know, he wants to replay the level,
yeah,
at the end of this. Like, oh, I could get it better if I went back in time again. So he's really thinking in video game terms, which is really part of his personality, you know.
Yeah.
He remembers his video game training, essentially. So I like all of that stuff. And it's always fun to see a parallel reality, like an alternate world that is created by a time change. So in this case, just like the Earth is revolving like 1 second, or it's like moving at a different speed around the sun, there's a delay. And so it misses the Kryptonian. Well, it doesn't miss the Kryptonian vessel, but it doesn't fall in Kansas, obviously.
Yeah.
It doesn't create a Flash. Abin-Sur doesn't. His ship breaks up in the atmosphere because it hits it at a different angle. Just a 1 second change actually created a totally other reality.
Yeah.
And there was a moment where I was, well, is there still a Flash? Because Barry calls himself the biggest Flash fan, but it's a reference to him reading Flash comics. And of course, the JSA still exists.
Yeah.
So there was a Flash. There was all of these superheroes, but there doesn't seem to be a new age of superheroes.
No. I don't know why there's no Jay Garrick.
Well, there is a Jay Garrick, isn't there?
No.
Is he not in the JSA fight scenes?
I have not seen him.
You may be right. The one of the, let me see. Green Lantern?
I mean.
No, he's not there. Well, the reason he's not there is because the moment that Extant has chosen is an actual moment from All-Star Comics.
Ooh.
So in All-Star Comics number 7, by Gardner Fox, Sheldon Mayer, you know, that late 1941 story starts with the same meeting where Green Lantern is late and wants to discuss what to do about war orphans. And then there's a whole story about them collecting, raising $1 million.
Okay.
So this is an actual story from 1941.
Oh, that's cool.
If Jay Garrick wasn't sitting there, they didn't use him. But obviously he existed. It's just he's not present at those events, and they've kept that quite correct.
Wow.
That's interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, I didn't notice that Jay wasn't there. I took it for granted that he was. But, you know, Green Lantern has just become chairman. We see there's Johnny Thunder, there's the Atom, Hourman, Dr. Fate, Hawkman.
Sandman.
You know, I guess Jay Garrick didn't take part in that adventure.
Huh.
Spectre. And Spectre gets frozen in time so that he doesn't participate. He doesn't, like, screw things up. But he's also sitting at that table. So, essentially, this is like a moment that happens just before the War Orphan story or just after that first meeting. We cut away because about this, it's a change in history. This fight shouldn't have happened at all.
Yeah.
What do you think of Extant? I don't know. Like, especially after reading the Booster Gold, where he's reporting to Parallax. Here, Extant is very much, you know, I hate Parallax. He hijacked my plan. It just feels like they were never really in cahoots.
I think it's a different reverse time flow. It feels like Extant now knows that it's going to happen, so he tries to fix it while everything is going on.
No, because he makes a mention that he's been trying to do this for 1,000 years, that there are all sorts of untold stories where, from his perspective, he tries to undo his defeat at Zero Hour, but is stopped by the Linear Man or Wave Rider. They get defeated at Zero Hour, but he escapes, remember?
Yeah.
At the end of that Parallax is moved through space with Green Lantern, and there's stuff that happens there, but Extant just disappears, basically. And what we're told here, he's been trying to screw time up, he's been trying to reverse that defeat, he's been trying to make himself top boss in this whole thing.
Yeah.
He's probably scapegoating Parallax. It's like if Parallax hadn't jumped in and hijacked the plan and had his own way of doing it, what could I have achieved as Monarch / Extant? I don't know. I don't know what's going on there, but it just seems to imply that there are many Extant stories that we know nothing about.
And for some reason, I believe that in most of these stories, he has an enormous beef with the JSA.
This is one of the reasons that this really does count. I mean, yes, he's trying to reverse Zero Hour in some way, but putting the JSA in there, when they were his victims during Zero Hour, even though here they're red herring. Nothing's happened to this JSA that cannot be rectified. It's saving this one guy. You know, it's changing history, but while you're looking at the big change and fixing it, there's this little change that you didn't notice. Ha ha. Nobody noticed this one guy that is supposed to die. You're so busy saving people that you're not going to think this guy needs to die, which is obviously a time travel trope. The city on the edge of forever. It's well played, but he uses the JSA as his pawns, like makes them responsible for it. Or in a way, one of the things that I felt like, oh, I felt bad for Impulse, although that's not where his head is at any time. And it's too much of a comedy for that to actually be the case, but I feel like there's an awful lot of putting people's fated deaths on the kid's shoulders.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, like that guy needs to die. Like, of course, Impulse is not going to kill him, but he's going to allow a man to die because he's supposed to die in history. And also, he's just met his grandfather, you know, Barry Allen is his grandfather. And he knows that if he rectifies the timeline, his grandfather goes back to being dead.
Yeah.
So that's a lot to put on this kid, although he never really seems to, you know, it doesn't really make a mark. He's sad to go and he's happy to have seen his grandfather and spend that time with him. And he knows he's lying to him by saying, I got to fix the timeline. He's like, yeah, you sure do, because I'm going to be the Flash. Yeah, you are. But also, yeah. You know, you're not going to survive to this particular date. This could have been a much darker, somber story, you know, but it's Impulse. So it's never going to be like that.
No, but it still drives him, you know. It still pushes him to do it and do it quickly. And, I mean, in the end, he loses Barry. But if he doesn't lose Barry, he loses Max. And, you know, it's not weighing him down. But I think it does that part of the story where he's, you know, changing history or putting history back is for a greater good. I think it drives him.
Yeah, we understand that this is what you should be doing, obviously. And I love how I was talking about the video game thing earlier, but with Impulse, he's often thinking in ideograms. You know, he's this is the way his series was played as well. You know, when he thinks, it's an image. And in this case, it's like he's flipping through a manual, a video game manual, game rules. And he remembers the rule, the villain's powers cannot affect you directly, because that, I mean, Exton just said that.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. So if I'm fighting the big boss, and this is true, that his powers can't do anything against me specifically, then I've got a shot. And he does it, you know. So he's got a lot of little tricks in here. You know, how do we find this one scientist that nobody knows who, what he looked like? And at super speed, checks all the driver's licenses.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of nice little moments like that that work with super speed, that works for Impulse. There are moments that I'm just baffled by, you know, like Rich Max Mercury is which? Blonde hair, brown hair, white hair? I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I think it goes a bit fast at times. You know, like when Hunter, the linear man, gets hit.
We can just call him Cable because, you know.
I know. Yeah. He's the Rip Hunter who is Cable. Which is a time travel joke in itself.
Yeah.
But Hunter gets hit, and then I guess it sends him to the future. It sends him to that moment where he trashes the museum.
Yeah.
And tells him, you got to go back. But he's already there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't really put any emphasis on that. So you got to kind of figure it out for yourself. This story needed a couple extra pages to explain everything, maybe. I'm not saying it does have to explain everything, but there are some moments that you only might get on a second read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a multiple read comic book, that's for sure. If you want to get everything, you want to catch every detail and everything, you got to read it more than once, that's for sure.
So I'm not ready to say that every little extant appearance is a 0 hour tie-in, but if you're going to have Parallax or at least mention him, and in this case the Justice Society, you know, who were the event's editorial target,
yeah,
I'm going to count it. So in fact, this is why we are going to cover JSA number 11 to 15 in our next and last episode.
Ooh.
Because you got all those pieces working together. But what else? People at home, you tell us. You've got a couple weeks before we tape our last episode at this point. You know, is there something 0 hour that you want us to cover that you think is totally a tie-in or a direct sequel to The Crisis in Time? Speak now or forever hold your peace.
Yeah, because we're done, baby.
Yeah, leave those comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com or your preferred means of communication, because we're not coming back to this after that.
No, no. Not unless we go back in time and restart everything.
We're not going to do that.
We're not going to do that.
So speaking of comments, we'll take a short break. When we return, your feedback on our previous episode.
Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl.
Commander Steel.
Power Seven Man. Soldiers of Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps. And now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire & Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Letters lost in time.
Letters lost in time.
Excerpts from your comments on our coverage of Wonder Woman, Hawkman, and Aquaman numbers 0. Isamu Yukinori thinks the Mask of Proteus started in this story as Diana's secret identity during the contest, because in issue 1 of the post-crisis series, Hippolyta decreed that all 200 participants had to be equally masked with full helmets. So I guess this is a post-crisis in time change.
Well, now.
And Chris Franklin adds that having Diana pose as a blonde might be a reference to Linda Carter in the Wonder Woman TV show, having done the same in her version of the origin. And then Isamu also thinks maybe in Super Friends that's how they did it? That there was a blonde? Maybe. Diablo Frank says, Ange and I objectively oversold the contest, this storyline, on DCOCD, but given that it was competing with the slog of Nightfall and the creaky Reign of the Supermen that were being worshipped like golden calves, it was a great book within their company. Just as Diana finally had art of a quality that she could actually attract a large mainstream audience, the stories I'd been lauding took a turn towards Image Comics to match the visuals. the extended Challenge of Artemis arc was still a lot more coherent than most, and a damn sight prettier. At the same time, it was paying off threads from the beginning of William Messner Loeb's run, so number 100 carried a lot less weight if you hadn't read the White Magician stories starting in issue number 66. It was a lot of baggage, I guess.
Yeah.
Speaking of baggage, Hawkman. Chris Franklin says, poor Hawkman. No one knew what to do with him. This series is basically the equivalent of taking all the leftovers in the fridge, sticking them in the blender, and calling it dinner. That dinner obviously caused food poisoning, as after this series, DC decreed Hawkman to be radioactive. They wouldn't even let Golden Boy Grant Morrison have anything to do with him in JLA. And that's why we got Zor-El.
Yeah. That was a weird twist on Hawkman.
David S. Gutierrez can't believe his ears. Bass like the Hawkman. I love that we're seeing some real growth on this show. Frank calls us out on our conclusions, reminding us that the Netherworld stuff was actually John Ostrander's idea and Messner Loeb's merely inherited it. That Count Viper, yes, was the big bad of the next four issues or so, but not the whole rest of the series, framing him as the Bear Avatar versus Katar as the Hawk Avatar. He's called Count Viper. I mean, come on. Yeah. Why is he a bear avatar? Oh, yeah. God. Anyway, according to Frank, Messner Loeb's was probably handed an assignment with a lot of editorial input, and so we should cut him some slack. But in the context of the discussion, I don't think it much matters if the Netherworld sticks around four issues or a single issue, 20 issues. I mean, it's all that same old baggage. And whether or not editorial is responsible, Bill has his name on it, such as life, I guess, in the work-for-hire game.
Yeah.
But thanks for the corrections or the clarifications, Frank. Captain Entropy says, as a rule of thumb, if a comics creator can't sum up who the character is, how they came to be, or who they are, and why they do what they do in a page or less, the odds are weighed against that character. This version of Hawkman couldn't come close and failed spectacularly as a result. You can convolute the plot and you can add special features to the identity or the origin, but those special features cannot be essential to understanding the character. Rob McCarthy's pitch for a new Hawkman is to make him the teenage son of Hawkman and Hawkwoman. As a married couple, they could have a kid. So it seems he's forgotten Hector Hall, who became Silver Scarab and even Dr. Fate for a time, and their godson Northwind, both legacy characters who could have taken that mantle. Those characters do exist, but they've never done like a young Hawkman.
No, really, huh?
I don't know.
It probably would be something to consider. I mean, Hawkman is kind of cool and he could easily be something. We could win with him being younger.
Well, a lot of people have just not read the most recent Hawkman series, which I think really decodes the character, uses all the stuff that that they should be using, somehow explains everything that's happened in these weird issues without it being awful. So okay. I will send you to the most recent and the best Hawkman series since Joe Kubert drew him. All right. So finally, comments on Aquaman number 0. Chris admits he really dug this Aquaman at the time. Now it seems very gruesome and cynical and probably should have been David's own original character rather than a redo of Aquaman. I will always give it points for being bold and fairly original, though. Frank was a big fan of Peter David's work, but didn't work for him on Aquaman. He gave in to some of his worst impulses. It was basically a watered-down version of his own Hulk work by way of a poor man's Submariner with an intolerable level of fish buns. Well, I mean, fish buns work for some people. I like fish buns. It's a very Acadian thing, fish buns. We've won some improv tournaments with fish buns, so something good about fish buns. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, I was crestfallen by how quickly David drowned my newfound enthusiasm for Aquaman in Bronze Age and Chromium Age tropes. He stopped buying it with issue 13. You heard drowned, and if you read his whole comment, there's a lot of other water puns, so pot calling the kettle black. Then Tim Price, also a Peter David fan, says he loved it. And he also wonders if the episodes of the podcast should have counted down to 0. Well, yeah, Tim, I guess I know, but we would have been locked into an unchangeable number of episodes, and I don't know that it would have been a smart way to plan it for, you know, 3 years in advance. Or it might have been mostly confusing to listeners. They're trying to listen to it from the beginning, and they're going back to the wrong one.
We could do it if we go back in time and start
and redo the whole thing. Correct. And on that thought, we'll mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. So if you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Get on the zero list at patreon.com/FW Podcast before it's too late. just like these fine folks did. They got on the zero list. They are going to escape the cataclysmic time wave that's coming from both ends of history. Jim Ball has been saved from Dinosaur Island circa 1944. David Capoon has been saved from a Smallville corn maze. Michael Bailey has been saved from near future Gotham City, which has become a fascist city-state. And Diablo Frank has been saved from the green, where he had his foot stuck between two roots. A reminder that you too can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow Fire and Water's Facebook page or on Twitter. The account is FW Podcasts.
Next time on Zero Hour Strikes, the last episode ever.
Yeah.